Welcome to the Secure AF Podcast. I'm Jonathan Kimmett. We have Tanner Shin here. We are going to talk about the SolarWinds SEC and CISO relationship currently and what that's going to mean for CISOs moving into the future. So, Tanner, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
So, the situation is this. The SEC has put charges against SolarWinds and the CISO of SolarWinds for effectively not communicating correctly and or addressing known security issues that ultimately led to the data breach from a couple of years ago. Now, this is kind of unique, or this is at least the first time that this has really happened, where an individual CISO is now being targeted or charged by the SEC for either hiding or not talking about with the board, with the public notifications and such, security problems in the organization. So that's really kind of what we're talking about today. So let me ask you, what do you know about the SolarWinds breach itself from a couple of years ago? Not the CISO stuff, but what happened with the SEC? So let's let everyone know what, if they don't know already.
I feel like I barely remember. So it's been a long time. This is regarding like the initial breach from way back where all the government facilities had.
I think the tool is called Orion.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, they got breached, same as anybody else, and they tried to sweep it under the rug, essentially, is what happened, right?
Yeah.
And then a bunch of companies got downstream hit in what I would call really the first big supply chain attack. I don't think there had been any notable supply chain attacks for that, at least anywhere close to that scale.
Not like that one.
Yeah, you're right. That was the first of, like, the big scale.
Yes. I mean, we've had a couple of them that were kind of supply chain. Home Depot was kind of supply chain.
Yeah.
But it wasn't to the scale.
Right. That was the first one that was like, oh, okay, a vendor screwed up and companies got hurt.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah. But I mean, that's it in a nutshell, you know?
Yeah.
They got owned, then their customers got owned, and they attempted to hide it.
Yep. I mean, that was effectively, they didn't want to tell anyone they knew about it, and they didn't tell anybody, and then it came out, and then they kind of resisted telling about more and more about it. And then the SEC started investigating. So that was the gist of the problem. And, you know, as a CISO, I understand completely, you know, both sides of the situation, because, you know, a CISO may either be told to or otherwise want to hold on to any information that looks bad for the company in terms of hurting reputation, whatever. But on the flip side, if you are in charge of a system or maintain the security of something that's going to harm people down the line, I mean, that's problematic. In this particular case, I mean, I've read a couple of different articles about this, and it seems like everybody in the company knew there were security problems. But the CISO was not relaying that information or even maybe even recognized that problem and sent that up to the board. So the CISO didn't tell the board and or didn't put in the reports that they had these security issues. And I think that is what the SEC is going after. So what do you think about that? I mean, what do you think about the effect to CISOs of that thing happening?
I think it puts in a terrifying legal precedence that it's really hard to prove intent. If you can say that, it's not even just that. I mean, that's one thing that's terrifying is proving intent. Can you really say that he did that on purpose? Like, maybe that guy just sucks as a CISO.
Okay, and that's fair, but I don't think it's hard to prove negligence.
It can be. I mean,
he
what
do it? I mean,
yeah, sure.
He didn't know about it where he probably should have. Mm-hmm. If all of his staff knew about it, which is what the articles are saying.
Should you go to jail for sucking at your job?
If it harms people, yes.
Okay. So, I mean, it's fair, I guess, to an extent. But the other thing is, we don't know also other pressures within.
Oh, no, absolutely.
Did the CEO say something to him? Did the board say something to him? Did they?
Well, and that comes down to the issue, because if a CISO now, it feels like in the industry over the last probably 5 years, really, there is pressure on the CISOs to be detached from the organization to an extent.
Right.
So they're not being influenced by leadership or by the board. I mean, when we're talking about DPO within GDPR, using a lot of acronyms, but the General Data Protection Regulation, they wrote in the kind of the function of the data protection officer or data privacy officer, sorry, to be that no one could influence them. You know, that was how they wrote it. It's like, this person has to report to the board. They have to be given enough resources to do their job, and they don't basically report to anybody except the board. And I think that there's a lot of pressure now from a CISO's point of view of being that type of person in some organizations where they're not being influenced by IT. They're not being influenced by senior leadership. When there's a problem, they have a direct line of communication to the board and or to the auditors or regulators or whatever to report problems.
Yeah, I don't think that's free of its own. I think you could have the same problem, though. Yeah, you're cutting out one single point, but you can still have a whole board of people who decide, no, our shares are pretty important. If you come out that we had a problem and you push out those patch notes and people know that we had that problem, yeah, our stock's going to drop. You're going to hurt my wallet.
Well, and I mean, we believe that this has happened before with a very large company that had a very large data breach a few years ago of something like 3 billion accounts. And the CISO, the breach had been happening for a very long time, for several years. The CISO at the time that the breach was happening left the company. A new CISO comes in. There was eventually a notification out to the world like, hey, all these accounts have been breached. And they were trying to lay blame on the old CISO.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the old CISO, again, this is all stories and rumors and stuff, but this is why it went through the industry. The old CISO had a gag order. He couldn't talk about it. But the other people in the security department and IT said, no. He told them about this stuff. He told them that there was indicators of compromise in the system. They didn't want to hear it. That's why he left.
Yeah, but that's still he said, she said at that point.
Absolutely, it is. But what I'm leaning towards on that is there is this conflict between if a CISO is telling the organization, hey, there is bad stuff here, and the organization is saying, you can't say anything about that, it's probably time to move to a new organization. You know, you're putting yourself at risk. You're putting the organization at risk. So I would not blame a CISO for walking away in that situation.
No, I think it's the responsible thing to do.
Absolutely.
But the legal precedence is still what scares me at that point. Because what if something happens 2 weeks after you left and they say, oh, he was the CISO for 3 years?
That's true. You know, and that's how the way I deal with that is CISO recommendations, formal CISO recommendations that are documented. So I have copies of the recommendations. The organization has copies of the organization or the recommendations. So that when I say, hey, this needs to be done for these reasons, there's documentations all the way around. And if that were to happen and I have those recommendations, I was like, hey, no. I told them, kerchunk, this is what they need to do. That is, it's a CYA thing, for one thing.
Yeah.
But it's also formal documentation of doing a risk assessment, which is required by most compliances.
I'm personally still not a big fan. So I think that the thing that scares me is let's take the same logic. Where a company got breached, and whose fault is it? Like, right? Let's come down to there was a SOC analyst who maybe he's just not the best SOC analyst, but he's doing his job. He looked over an alert, thought it was a false positive, marked it false positive. It wasn't. They got breached because of it. Does he go to jail? Should he go to jail?
So, I mean, the piece that I would add to the piece that I would qualify that with is, did the SOC analyst do his procedures and his learning as he was trained?
Let's say even if he made a mistake.
Okay, he made a mistake. Was anybody harmed?
I mean, hypothetically, let's say the company got ransomware and lots of people lost money.
Then maybe yes.
Okay.
Or if somebody got hurt. You know, usually when I talk about harm, I'm talking about someone hurt, say you're physically hurt, or died or whatever. But when we're looking at a certain amount of monetary, you know, impact, yes. Now, I guess my question is this, was what I would ask in a situation like that is, was the SOC person qualified? Would other people have made that same decision? And if you can justify it either way, if you had 5, 10, 15 other SOC analysts come in, look at the same data, and if they said, yeah, we probably would have ignored that as well. And I actually, this comes up in our tabletops all the time, where I'll present something in the tabletop and I'll ask the question, what would you do? You know, here's an example. You get a somebody who puts in a ticket of this one thing going wrong on their computer, whatever it may be. And my question to the group is, would this constitute an incident for incident response?
Right.
And security people might raise their hand and say, absolutely, it would. But when I turn and I look at the help desk people, it's like, would you guys actually constitute that as an incident? No, that's a ticket. That's 100 tickets we see every day. It's like, okay, well, now here's the dilemma. They see it as an incident. They see it as a ticket. IT security sees it as an incident. So where's the breakdown? Where's the communication or the training or the experience or the troubleshooting, the checklist, whatever it may be, to help that individual to make a determination? Do accidents just pure raw accidents happen? Well, sure it does. Should somebody go to jail for a single mistake, a single accident? Maybe.
I mean, in my opinion.
If that accident led to death.
I mean, as long as there wasn't intent, in my opinion, no. Like,
that's a hard one. I mean, and this is why this is a big issue, by the way.
So I feel like opening that door, you're going to have a whole lot of SOC people think, I do not make enough for that. I am not paid enough for what's happening here.
And I agree with that. Now, hold on. I do agree with that. I understand that. But I think that's where your threshold and your troubleshooting come in. Because you want to give that SOC person, whoever that may be, the appropriate amount of training, the appropriate amount of decision-making capability, and the background on the decision-makings to make a decision right then. However, if it's a mistake, a pure mistake, and everyone would agree, it's like, yeah, it was a mistake. If a court would agree with that, if it's a mistake, okay. A jury would agree with it. Oh, maybe.
I don't know. I think it's putting a lot of faith in our courts. But the other thing that I was thinking is it's also taking a ton of liability off of the company, right?
Yes.
Should the company not be doing some kind of internal test to ensure these things don't happen? Should they be making sure people are trained, vetting employees, making sure these things don't happen?
Yes.
And then
yes.
To take this one step further, let's say going past SOC, there was an IT guy that didn't update his server.
Yep.
Is he legally liable? At what point does the company take the blame for hiring these people and having this work environment and training?
I agree. And that comes down to that Yates memo from a few years ago.
Yeah.
Of individual accountability for corporate wrongdoing. So individual decision makers who make a decision to do or not do something, and that leads to harm. Again, we're talking harm, so there's a certain level or threshold of that. But let's say you have a system administrator, and we have all heard this. I am not going to deploy Windows updates. It always breaks my server, so screw Microsoft. I've heard that 1,000 times. I always go back and say, okay, hold on. You are going against the manufacturer's recommended critical security updates to that system. You are rejecting their recommendation to update this to pass these critical updates. That's a liability that I don't think IT people and system administrators can absorb. Now, it may be that the organization can accept that risk, but that should not be on that individual decision maker. That should be going, that's a problem. The change management goes in the system. It has to be approved by either the group, the leadership, however the change management works. But if a system administrator does not deploy that patch, and he or she is the only person in that decision, and that leads to harm, then yeah, I think that's a problem.
So you don't think it would be the company's fault for not having audits to find that out, vetting and training?
I think that there's absolutely liability on both sides, sure. But the ultimate decision is that system administrator. Now, I will say that compliances are now pushing against this because there's a lot of compliances that do require that sort of auditing against the patch management system and their reporting. The audits that I've been doing here recently, the questions that I'm asking based on the compliances is, what is the interaction of projects as it relates to cybersecurity to leadership and to the board? What risk assessments have you completed to a particular new software or a new deployment, a new process, and how has that been presented to the board? Now, you're not necessarily ascending the risk assessment itself, but you're discussing it with leadership and the board. You're going up the line. And a lot of organizations they think a risk assessment is that one pen test they do a year, or they sit down and they do a risk registry once a year. And it's not. The compliances are wanting us to do these risk assessments upon almost any major change and a lot of medium changes and some minor changes. If there's a change in the organization, whether it be something like a patch or a new process, a new server deployment, a new operating system deployment, a new whatever, then you do a risk assessment to determine how this is going to be. So I think that the compliances are pushing organizations into a different mindset by doing that, by preventing that single point of failure, such as a system administrator that just decides he's not going to deploy a patch. I think it's getting there, but I think it's because of all these problems that have happened that these people have made the decision not to do it, and that led to harm. I mean, the reality is WannaCry would have never happened if had everybody done their Windows updates. Sorry, it would not have been as widespread if people had done, because the patch has been released, what, 2 months before?
Yep. Was it even?
Yeah, I think it came out in January, and then WannaCry was March, something like that. I mean, it was several months before.
February. There was a whole Valentine's Day approach before it and stuff. And yeah.
I remember when I did my reports for the organization I worked for, and we found a bunch of desktops that were vulnerable to it. And it's like, why aren't you getting patches?
Yep.
You know, one of the things that I've been, you know, working with organizations on is, instead of doing a yearly vulnerability scan or even a quarterly, you do monthly. So you can compare it to your patch management processes.
Yeah.
So if you've deployed your patches and you run your vulnerability scan that month, you know, after you run it, you got a list, you run it the next month, you go, wait a minute, that patch didn't get up there. In fact, I was at an organization not too long ago, they did it like that. And when I was doing the audit, I was reading through and it's like, oh, here you go. This vulnerability was in two different patch cycle or two different vulnerability assessments, but both of them had different tickets working on it.
Yeah.
So they were trying to address it, trying to figure out why it wasn't working. And so they were going through the process of evaluating the risk and otherwise mitigating that risk. But that monthly vulnerability scan, you can compare it to your patch management reports and you can go pretty quickly go, oh, okay, there's a problem here.
That goes back to something I always say that a lot of people don't like to hear me say, which is vulnerability scans are to verify your patching process.
Absolutely.
They're not to find vulnerabilities. They're to verify your patching process.
Right.
Yeah, cool. I'm glad you agree with that. A lot of people don't.
I want checks and balances on everything, you know, and patch management, the only checks and balances, short of going and touching each machine and verifying it, but even that doesn't work because you can go check for updates and it says, oh, I'm all happy, because it's pointing to a WSS server that's locked up.
Yeah.
You know, so you really need to have that extra third-party objective scan to tell you, are you really getting authenticated scans, by the way, not just a passive scan across the network on a couple of machines. A true authenticated scan on the box.
Well,
that will tell you if you have those vulnerabilities, those patches missing on that box.
I would say that there's actually levels to that. The most important thing is unauthenticated. By far, the most important thing you can do is what you can see without credentials.
Yes, I agree with that, except when you want to understand if your patches are being deployed.
Oh, for sure, for sure. But if you're looking for any point of criticality, I think ideally you should do both.
Absolutely.
Like if you're concerned about it from a security standpoint,
yes.
Yeah. Yes. Unauthenticated, tenfold more important.
Right.
Then you should do your authenticated scans. They're both important.
No, I agree. I just, so many people do unauthenticated scans, but they don't get the value of that authenticated scan to see what's on the inside of that machine.
Right. Yep. Makes sense.
So.
Sure. So I guess let me ask you, what would you do if somebody came to one of the companies that you do vCISO for and they said, hey, this thing that you weren't aware of, they got breached by that and they had known about that and they swept it under the rug. Could you prove that you weren't aware of it? What would be the actions there for you?
Well, that comes down to what are my responsibilities as vCISO? Because it's unique as a vCISO, because you kind of have a slightly different role in the environment of being advisory or whatever. But in some cases, if there is a vulnerability in an organization and I should have known about it, I should have asked that question, then should we start that over? I think
we should now.
Yeah. Okay, clap. All right, Robert, we're going to clap so you can see it. So you should ask the question again, and I'll start the answer again. How does your nose feel? Okay.
Okay, how would I phrase that exactly?
If something, if a vulnerability in the organization, that I'm a vCISO.
Yeah, okay. So Jonathan, let me ask you, if one of the companies that you're vCISO for, let's say that they had a problem in the organization that they knew about, but they never mentioned it to you, and that became something that they got compromised by, and they tried to say, hey, you're in charge of security here. You should have known about this. This is negligence from you. We're taking you to court. We're going to lock you up, throw away the key.
So I think that vCISO is a kind of a unique position. If the organization knew that this was going on and they did not relay that to me in any official communications, any processes, any risk assessments that we are doing with them, then that might limit some of the liability that I would have. And also depends on the contract and what my relationship was with them, because in some cases I am strictly advisory. You know, I go into an organization, they ask me questions, and I provide them answers, I provide them training, I do whatever. In some cases, we have the contract is I'm much more involved and I require them to have, do the scanning, provide the reports and do all those sorts of things. So it depends on what that relationship. But if I was a CISO, pure CISO in that situation, and they did not tell me, and it is something I should have known, any CISO coming in should have known, such as patch management. Maybe they weren't doing patch management. They didn't want to do patch management. And then I come in. They didn't tell me they weren't doing patch management. And that's not generally a security role. I mean, that's usually IT doing the patch management.
Yeah, yeah.
But I did not check it. And I did not evaluate it. And I did not, ask for reports. And then, I would say that there's going to be some liability on my shoulders.
Okay. That's fair.
And that sucks.
Yep.
But I think it's also a priority for the CISOs or for security professionals in general that when they are part of an organization to ask questions. And one of the questions that always comes up is if somebody is qualified to do something. And we talked about this in another podcast. And my definition of qualified is not any particular certification or training or whatever. It's would 10 other CISOs think this person is qualified? So I would take that same mindset in the situation of here is, would 10 other experienced CISOs have done the same thing or have known the same thing or would have asked the same questions? And I think that might tell you whether or not it was appropriate for that CISO to know or say something about it. Now, it's all hindsight for a lot of like the SEC and the SolarWinds. It's all hindsight. We can say whatever we want about this CISO. And I don't know him. I don't know if he's a good CISO or a bad CISO. I know what the SEC has otherwise charged. However, I do know individuals out there in organizations that they're in a weird spot. because they see security problems. The organization might be resistant to realizing the effect of that or the risk of that, and otherwise doing something about it. So what does the CISO do? I mean, I think the SEC is putting pressure on CISOs because that is a point in which the CISO, being experienced and or qualified, should recognize the risk of something and be able to communicate that out to whoever it may need to be going to. The question is, would they or should they? Now, one of the things that I brought up not too long ago in this conversation is, in some cases, if you have certain certifications, you have agreed to an ethics code. And that ethics code does specifically say that if you see problems, you do have to communicate to people. You have to present that to regulators or, you know, legal, whatever it may be. And that's part of you keeping that certification. And I have some of those certifications. I've got at least five of them that have very specific terminology in there that I agreed to upon accepting the certification, that if I were to see problems, I need to report it. You know, I can't hide it. Now, I don't know what certifications the SEC guy had, or if he had any of those, I don't know. But I know what I agreed to, because I do actually read all those pieces of paper, as I encourage everybody to, that if you sign to get that certification, and there's, it's not just certifications, there's also degree programs that will have an ethics code that you have to sign. Yeah, there's contractual agreements, you know, agreements that you sign when you get an employment that says you have to abide by federal law, which a lot of these acts are federal law, you know, GOBA or HIPAA or any of these. So those sorts of things you have to take consideration. If you don't say something, and I would go a little bit further to say, if you should have known, because it's really hard to do intent, if you should have known this was a problem and you didn't say anything about it, then that's a problem. That's an issue.
Okay. I mean, yeah. No, I hear where you're coming from. I think personally, I'm very glad that I'm on the red team. And, you know, I hope that that never extends to, hey, you didn't find this vulnerability, but I guess it could at this point. I mean,
maybe
you could take it all the way out to, hey, there was a vulnerable 0 day and you didn't find it. You didn't run a fuzzer long enough to find that.
Yeah.
You are negligent.
I think that's due diligence. I think that there should be due diligence there. But I think that really brings up a good question, because, and we're going to do hopefully another show about this, but about pen testing and about organizations who do a form of pen testing with tools that you may not get the in-depth part in there. They may not look deep enough into the situation to really do due diligence for that pen test. Mm-hmm. And I think that's problematic.
Yeah, I agree.
I mean, I'm not a pen tester, but when I'm thinking about stuff in a pen test and I go to someone and I was like, hey, I need to get a pen test. And you come in, not you, but if they come in and they say, or, you know, we're going to do your pen test. Great. But they only do 30% of it because they're running a vulnerability scanner.
Yep.
And they might check it against a handful of machines, and that's it. That's problematic.
Yes, it is. Yep.
So having an organization who does do a good pen test, and we can talk about what that means later in another podcast, but who does that pen test that a normal CISO, an industry standard CISO, you know, 10 CISOs again, would say, yes, that's reasonable. Doing a, let's say a brute force password crack. Let me ask you this, to kind of put it in scale. Do you think running 5 different passwords constitutes a brute force password attack from the point of view of a normal day-to-day pen test?
Going against a hash or password spraying?
Password spraying.
I mean, not really, kind of. That's like, it depends. If there's controls in place where you can only do 5, I mean, I don't know. I would expect more.
Right. Again, there's a lot of things to qualify that, but I would say that if a pen test company only tried 5 attempts to do a password crack or to brute force a password.
Yeah, I would be Yeah, would be questioning. You guys should have done more. Yeah.
Right. And again, there might be reasons for it, but just kind of a general rule set, if you only do five, that's not, I don't think that's enough from a CISO perspective. I would want you to try a password list, you know, a legitimate password list. So anyway, it's just an example. It's just really an example for conversation. It's really just kind of a teaser of us talking about the podcast coming up next time, or the next time we do the, Tanner and I does this together, talking specifically about pen tests and what they are and kind of the other pieces to it. Okay. So let's talk about what this, going back to the SEC and the CISO, what do we do from here? I mean, I kind of have a process in my head of what a CISO needs to do, but what do you feel like that if this goes forward and the charges against the CISO moves forward, and let's say he's found guilty, whatever it is, you know, whatever happens, whether it's monetary, it's actual criminal charges and there's jail time or whatever, this is significant.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think is going to change in the world for CISOs from this point forward?
Well, I don't know what will, but I mean, they need to take everything more seriously.
Absolutely.
Because there's this thing where you can go through your day to day and you can go, look, I have this problem at work. I keep telling my boss, everybody's had this happen. I keep telling my boss, nothing's happening. They won't fix it, blah, blah, blah. Like, but you have to realize that that point now becomes a point of frustration and contention and stress.
Yes.
To a point of you're going to jail.
Yeah.
Like they have to realize that and take that more seriously. And I think we're going to have a whole lot more CISOs, if they're smart, walking out of their jobs.
Okay. So I'm going to put a little twist in here because you sent something out on chat about 2 weeks ago now, about how attackers are going to regulators directly, people that they compromise. Do you think that there will be a requirement, or even maybe not necessarily a requirement, but an increase of CISOs going to regulators directly saying, hey,
no.
I don't know.
I think it's career suicide.
Oh, I don't think it's career suicide.
I do. What organization's going to hire you if she said, yeah, I was the guy that called them out for their BS on that one thing. Like, I mean, maybe if you have an organization.
What if it was
really
required, though? What if the SEC requires you? If you don't, you're going to jail.
I mean, I feel like it's very idealistic. I think realistically, there's a lot of organizations that are going to be like, no, you should have put the company first and kept your mouth shut.
See, I think I don't know. That's a hard one. Because if it becomes a requirement, and actually from the SEC perspective, it was a requirement to give that information out publicly because it goes into the reports. So I could definitely see it from a compliance perspective that if a CISO doesn't report this out, that there could be significant charges. And I could also see it from the point of view, kind of like what they did with the DPO and GDPR, that it is the requirement of that position to report it regardless of what the business wants. And the business can't retaliate against that. Now, they will. You know, people will do that. People will be people.
Yeah.
But I think it puts CISOs in a very strange dilemma. Again, going back to the ethics requirement of these certifications, if you want to keep your certifications, you have to do this. And if you're found that you didn't do it, you will lose that certification, be banned from it for life.
Yeah, but that's not that big of a deal compared to going to jail.
It is when we're talking about jobs.
I will give you all of my certs right now to not go to jail. I have dozens. I don't care.
And that's fair. And this is all academic. You know, we're just discussing it and talking about that. But I think it does raise the question. I think it raises the question of what will CISOs do? I had a great conversation last night with someone at an event, and they were talking about exactly what you said, that they have found a lot of things they want to get changed, and they're trying, and they're pushing, and they're getting pushback from the leadership. And my response really was what you said was, why feel what the questions you were asking are the right questions? And those were the same questions that I would ask in the organization if I was CISO there. They didn't have a CISO. It was a different position. But so you kind of have a choice whether or not you continue there. You know, yeah. Will you will you accept the risk being the person in charge of this if they're not willing to make the changes? The other piece that I had, this was many years ago now. This was probably 7 or 8 years ago. I got reached out by a headhunter, and they told me that there was a CISA position that had come open. And he wouldn't tell me the organization, but he says that starting salary, well, okay, I'll give you the requirements. I'm going to present it as it was presented to me. You tell me what you feel. So this CISO position does not require any sort of training or certification or experience. Does not have to have any previous security experience. The position pays $250,000 a year.
So you're the fall guy for a big company.
Yeah. So I asked him, because I know a lot of CISOs, at least in this area. It's like, I don't know of any CISOs that have come onto the market recently. You know, what happened? Because, well, I can't really tell you unless you're interested in doing the job. And so I started asking more and more questions. And eventually I got that. I got that the previous CISO left because the leadership was not listening to them. And it's like, oh, yeah, I'm not going to take that job. I'm not even going to apply for it. I'm not even interested in it. Because if they're not going to listen to you, that's a problem. So, but I mean, again, 7, 8 years ago, and I think that there may be some of that now, but that was several years ago. But now we're talking about there could be federal regulations, whatever that means. But even worse than that, I think that there is probably societal push for this. I think people want organizations to protect their stuff and their data. And I think that as we are start talking about industries that have direct effect on people, such as, let's say, the energy sector, let's say healthcare, anything that if it goes down, people may die. They might be pushing, regardless of the organizational leadership, that some positions of high criticality, like a CISO or a protection or a privacy officer or a risk officer, that they have an obligation to society to do these things. And it's not just about losing a job. It is about society influence on this person. I mean, what do you think about that?
I don't think you should try to regulate morality.
Okay, what do you do though? I mean, do you just let people, if they intentionally hide, if you can prove intention, if they're intentionally hiding security problems, and then somebody...
The company should have been diligent enough to know this and fired them ahead of time.
But who in the company?
I mean, the company is an organization. Like, a company is an entity, essentially.
Yes, but I think that that's one of the things about the Yates memo that's so interesting is there, when you're dealing with like an LLC or a corporation, the intent of the corporation is to protect individual decision makers. And they're specifically saying, no, we're not going to do that anymore. We're going after the individual decision makers because you can't hide behind the corporation. It's individual accountability for corporate wrongdoing. It's going after people that made the decisions.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I think it's all about intent, right? If you can prove this person intentionally did something, sure. You know, I mean, that's no different than somebody who goes and exfills data.
Sure.
You know, it's all the same. But yeah, I think it's a really fine line. And I think it's pretty scary, and it makes me not want to be a CISO. Like, I don't think I would ever take a job as a CISO after this.
Yeah.
I think that, you know, I could see it. You know, you go to a jury that I've seen a lot of court cases from the forensics and stuff that we do. And like, chances are the jury that you're talking to has no idea what any of this means.
Right.
And if they get a good lawyer who says, look, I'm painting this guy like he's the jerk. And what the reality is I was over here and I was trying to tell people, hey, we should fix this. They didn't fix it. Maybe I didn't document it well enough. Maybe that's the problem is I went to have a conversation with my supervisor and in person.
Yep.
And now
yep.
There's no paper trail. Like, the whole thing scares me as far as like the accountability that somebody could take, even if they were in the right. It's not that like, do I think the people who are purposely just hiding stuff should be at fault for it? Yes. Right. But I think that that's a very idealistic way of how it would be. I think that realistically, you're going to get some people who are ended up, you know, maybe they had somebody who, I actually know people who've heard this, who said, hey, whenever you find problems, come talk to me in person. Don't email me about it.
Yeah.
Like that type of thing. And then eventually, like if that comes down to that person, you know, that's the type of stuff that scares me. And I know we're getting a little long here, but I had one more thing I actually wanted to ask about.
Okay.
The majority of the companies that we do incident response for have common factors, and they are smaller IT department, oftentimes no dedicated security people, very usually.
Absolutely.
And they're all overworked to hell.
Right.
So whenever this type of thing happens for them, can they come and say, no, you were negligent, whenever you're a CIO who doesn't have a CISO, doesn't have a SOC, doesn't have hardly any security staff at all, if any, and you're just completely overworked, you know that things need to be updated, you're trying to get it done, but yeah.
Yes.
There's still a fault?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, let me qualify that. I think in today's age, from an organizational point of view, in some industries, I'm going to qualify that because I think that there's a lot of pieces there. If you are not implementing appropriate security controls through appropriate security expertise, that is negligence. And I think the industries are saying that. I think compliances are saying that. I think society is saying that. So if you have an organization who does not have any IT security, they don't have a VC, so they don't have any expertise, and they have chosen not to have that, that could be considered negligence.
But the question is that Acme Corp's problem or is that Jim Bob CIO's
problem? I think it's both. I think it's absolutely both. It is the decision. It is someone's decision within the organization. The organization can absolutely be held liable, and they have been held liable. But I think individuals can be held liable as well. And we're seeing that with the SEC, and we're seeing it with the ASML. We're seeing it in a lot of different things, that individuals could be held liable. So if you have that CIO who is responsible for IT, and they are not going out and finding it, if they have asked for help and expertise and a VCSO or to hire a security person or to get a third-party SOC or whatever, they've asked for that and they've been denied, then that decision has been went up the line. So it's not there specifically. But if they've not even asked for it, if they haven't presented it to the organization that we need to do these things, then yes, I think the liability would fall on that CIO or those IT leaders or even the IT individuals. Because in some cases, you can't necessarily expect leadership to understand what the risks are because no one has told them. But it should be at a certain level of IT and or IT security that you do present those risks up the line. That's also why there's a lot of requirements now to have security, professional security individuals on boards.
Yeah,
I was talking to someone, a friend of mine who's in the banking sector, and he was saying that this is a requirement now for them. You have to have expertise, security, a CISO or somebody on the board to help ask the questions of the organization to whether or not they're actually doing security correctly or focusing on security. One of the things I talk about is what is that qualified thing? You know, if you have somebody who is not staying on top of threat intelligence, who is not asking questions, who is not listening to podcasts or doing training or going to conferences or talking to professional industry, professional security people, if they're not doing any of that, I would not say that they can stay qualified. You're not staying on top of the threats. You're not staying on top of the changes in the industry.
Yeah.
So if you have a CIO or IT people that are not doing that, then they're certainly not going to know about new threats. If they don't have any training or any experience in security, they're not even going to know about the old threats. I think that that could be, from a jury perspective or even a judge's perspective, considered negligence if there was or is a security problem that led to harm.
Yeah, I think it's something that I think it's a really important case is what I think a lot of this comes down to.
Yes.
And I think people need to be, especially people in IT leadership roles, like we just talked about, CISOs, everything, very, very aware of what happens here. And you yes. need to realize that it's no longer you're protecting the company. You're also protecting yourself and your yeah. family.
Yes.
Because if you go to jail, it's going to be a big problem for you and your family. Most people don't like to spend time in jail.
Right.
So people are just going to have to pay a lot of attention to it. And if this happens to where, I don't know the current status, but I mean, if the CEO for SolarWinds gets charged and he's, you know, hey, they said he's negligent, he's going to jail for life.
Right. And I don't know what the actual charges are.
I'm exaggerating.
Yeah, no, exactly. But I think you're absolutely right. I think this case is extremely important, at least the ramifications of this case.
Right.
And I think you're right. Everyone needs to pay attention to this. A lot of people don't know about the Yates memo, but when that came out, that made huge ripples in the IT security community thinking about this. But now we have that next level of the SEC is actually doing something to an individual. Mm-hmm. And now one question does come up on whether or not they're doing it to the individual or if they're doing it to the position.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. Is it the fact that he was a CISO? That's why they're going after him, because he, in theory, should have known better or whatever. Or are they going after him as a person because they don't feel like he was qualified to be a CISO?
So there's that's another thing that terrifies me is I know a CISO from a very large organization, and he was a fantastic CISO, very good at his job. And he ended up getting let go because their company got hit with a zero day.
Yes.
Now, if that goes to court, how many people in the jury who know nothing about computers are going to understand zero day?
I know.
So like, can you go to jail because you got hit with a zero day? Maybe. The answer to that's going to be maybe.
So, and here's what I would say about that. You're absolutely right. Maybe. I mean, if you're doing it from a jury perspective or even from some, you know, judge's perspective.
Lots, yeah. Average age of a judge is very, very high. They don't know a lot about computers.
Right. However, I have dealt with several judges that they didn't know a lot about computers, but they absolutely asked.
That's fair.
And they would call up. I would have them call me in my previous position saying, you know, Jonathan, I can't tell you anything about the case, but here, blah, blah, blah. What would you think? What do you think about this? What would you do in this situation? Which is why I always say, what would 10 other CISOs do? Because that's how I'm going to present it to a judge. Because the judges do that. They go and ask questions. I would hope that if you got, let's say, the individual, the zero day guy, if it did go to court, I hope it never does. I mean, I hope he's fine and got a great new job. But if it ever went to court, that his defense attorney would present to the court, again, 10 other CISOs saying, hey, this is a zero day. Let me explain to you what it means. Here's what the other 10 CISOs would do. I think that has a huge impact on a jury and a judge.
Yeah, for sure. But now we're hoping that they have good defense, good judge, good jury.
Absolutely. And there's a lot of pieces to that.
Yeah.
But I would hope that that would be the process. And I think, again, I don't know all the pieces of this one and what the ultimate goal is. I think, just like with a lot of things in terms of societal functions, you know, when we're talking about laws, and it's the intent is to maintain a certain piece of society a certain way, it's a social construct, then they might be using this as an example, as a warning to all other CISOs saying, hey, don't do it this way. You know, you need to report, you need to make sure it's out there.
Yeah.
Now, what I would say is documentation is your friend.
Yes.
If you don't document your request, if you don't document your process, even to the extent of having like kind of like a D&O insurance, you know, where you are a decision maker, a board or whatever, and you have D&O insurance. I know CISOs that got insurance for their job, for what they did. It was personal insurance in case anything came back from what they did in the job.
Huh.
And I don't disagree with that in some cases, because you might get called upon based on a decision that you made that you need to defend. That can get really expensive. So having that sort of insurance might be a good idea. It's kind of like getting a if you become a private investigator or any of those, you had to get a bond. You had to go by and make sure you have copy in case you do something bad and they get covers that. It's the same thing with CISOs. They have gone out and they've gotten personal insurance to cover, excuse me, to cover the decisions that they make just in case it comes back and haunts them later. But documentation is your friend.
I think that's the big takeaway. That's the big takeaway is how this ends up. You have to document everything. Everything.
Yes.
Everything. And make it known.
Yes.
Like, you should already be doing this anyways. So I guess you could argue there is some good. But I mean, really, you have to at this point. It's no longer like a, if I say anything else, my boss is going to be pissed off. It's not that anymore. Now it's you have to do this or you go to jail.
Yep.
Like,
and we're talking about documentation. And it's not just documentation in terms of, hey, I told this person, you wrote down, hey, I let them know about this thing. It's what is an evaluation? What I do in my CISO recommendations is, here is the problem. Here's the risks that I have identified. Here's the recommendations for mitigating those risks. Mm-hmm. That is the full mitigate. That's the full process of the CISO recommendation. And I do it in kind of a traditional memo format. You know, it's not an email necessarily. It might be attached to an email, but it is a PDF that I have filled out and I have signed in some way, some digital signature, and that I have sent to the leadership saying, hey, this is what I am recommending. Now, at that point, they have a decision to make. Either they accept the risk or they mitigate in some way, you know, whether it was what I recommended or otherwise. But I feel like that I needed to do that to protect myself, saying, hey, this is what you need to do.
Sure.
Now, I started doing that many years ago to a CIO that is, you know, he's passed away now, but I would, I'd go in and I'd talk to him. I was like, hey, we need to do these things. And he would just forget. I would tell him, he would just forget.
Mm-hmm.
So at that point, it's like, okay, well, I need to have a little bit more, not just, and nobody loves email. So I just started doing it in PDFs in paper and I'd print them off for him. I had my copies and then I gave him the copies. And then me being the person I did, I would send to general counsel as well. That way, general counsel knew that risk was there and that, you know, but it was not anything negative towards him. He was busy. He forgot, just like you said earlier, overworked. So I wanted to make sure I documented it in a way that could be traced.
Yeah. Makes sense.
All right. I think we're at, I don't know what the timer says on this, but I think we're at about 50 minutes or so. So I think we'll end it here. So thank you so much for stopping by and listening to the Secure AF podcast. Tanner, thanks for coming in and having a conversation with me.
Yeah, always a good time.
Yeah, this has been fun. This is a good topic, and I expect that we might do some more of these as more things come out about this particular issue.
Yeah.
I think you're right. This will change the industry. It will change the industry for CISOs and the blue team and decision makers, and I think that's a good thing. I think it should change in some ways, and this may not be the best way to do it or what we would like to see in terms of change, but it will change.
Absolutely.
So, all right. Thanks, everyone. You have a great rest of the week, and we'll catch you next time on the Secure AF podcast.